Hi, welcome to Neuroverse, a podcast hosted by Carolina
and Clara, where we discuss all matters from neuroscience to philosophy and beyond. Hi, welcome back to Neuroverse. So today we have our second episode in our series that is in collaboration with Scientifica, Tools for Looking into the Brain. And today we're going to be talking about fluorescence microscopy. So we're going to talk all about what fluorescence microscopy is, the different types of microscopy that we can use to look at microstructures, and how they can be used in neuroscience to help us understand the brain and the things within it. So first of all, for some brief history on microscopes, I think we should acknowledge that it's pretty cool that we're able to look at structures that we can't see with the naked eye, because we're so limited as humans as to how much we can see. Like, if you look at your finger, the maximum scale that you can see is maybe some of the indentations of your fingerprint. But with a microscope, now we're able to look at scales much, much, much smaller than that and understand how single proteins act. And they're so useful for all the questions that we need to answer to understand biology. And initially, microscopes basically began as magnifying glasses, so people just used like glass stones. Eventually, they created the first microscopes, which were just a bunch of these stones on top of each other to magnify things even more, which were called compound microscopes. And then in the 17th century, Robert Hooke created the first microscope setup, which includes a stage, an illuminator, and focus controls to look at samples. And then ever since then, so many different types of microscopes have been developed with higher spatial resolution and also greater speed, which are two of the main priorities in microscopy, I would say. And now fluorescence microscopy specifically involves the process of fluorescence, which is when light energy in the form of photons is absorbed by specific molecules, and then they emit some of the light energy a few nanoseconds later, so that some of the energy is lost in the process and the emitted photon has less energy than the absorbed photon.
And this is the wavelength that we see.
Yeah. And so different proteins have different absorption and emission spectrums, which means like different wavelengths, which means different colors in the category of visible light. And basically, in biology, we can take advantage of these principles of fluorescence by using antibodies to label specific proteins with fluorescent proteins. And these fluorescent tags can then be imaged to indicate specific structures of a specified color.
Yeah.
And then you can multiplex them to take images of, for example, different proteins together and understand how they interact. Or, for example, you can label different cell types and understand how they're connected or how they interact. Or you could label a nucleus and specific channels or proteins in the membrane, or like a subcellular region.
Yeah, some proteins already are naturally fluorescent, like GFP.
Green fluorescent protein.
Yes, but others can be like activated. And this was also in part what you were talking about earlier with the antigen binding. And so this is immunohistochemistry, and it's quite cool the way that it works, in the sense that first you need to do antigen retrieval, because when you have like tissues or samples, you need to first fix them. And when you fix them, you can lose a lot of the antigens that you need to label. So then you first go through a process where you retrieve them, and then you also use detergents to help with this retrieval, which helps mimic the lipid bilayer that you have on your membrane. And then onto this, you then have a bunch of like immunoenzyme techniques, where you either have like a direct approach, where you like immediately bind the antigen to the antibody, or you have an indirect approach where you first need to add in like a primary antibody and then a secondary antibody. And yeah, it's pretty cool because, as Clara mentioned, as long as we have like the right antibodies and antigens, we can really target whatever proteins we like, and it allows for so much specificity in terms of, well, for example, like in neurons, you can have the same type of neuron, but maybe in different areas of the brain, they have a slightly different gene. And so you can target like specific types of neurons in different areas of the brain, which allows for like such awesome science, not only in vitro studies, but also in vivo. So then you can target these groups of cells, which can be visualized with so many different types of microscopes, which we'll get into.
Yeah. And I think the coolest part is the ability to label multiple things at the same time. So normally you can have up to 4 different channels or 4 things labeled, just because of the specificity of fluorescent proteins. They usually have a wavelength range for their absorption. And so to prevent overlap, you can have around 4, like blue, green, red, and far red. That's really useful to just look at multiple things at the same time. So like you can label a neuron and its synapses and its nucleus to get a full picture of what you're looking at.
Yeah, and just going back to what we were talking about in terms of the fluorescent proteins, I found this really cool study, which is a light and calcium gated transcription factor for imaging and manipulating activated neurons. And basically, this lab developed a reporter that can control the expression of a transgene in response to cellular calcium activity. And calcium activity is important because it is used as a readout for neural activity. So it's a way to record what is happening with the cells. And so instead of just recording the calcium activity and recording the fluorescence full stop, what they did is they were able to create a snapshot of the neural activity at the relevant time point that they wanted in terms of the molecular mechanisms happening. And they did this by engineering a calcium activated protease, which cut a protein sequence to reveal a transcription factor when calcium level rises. And the specificity of the transcription factor, I think, is super cool because it's something that only happens at a specific time point in the cellular reactions. And in this case, it's when the calcium level rises. And so they did this through enzyme-directed evolution to engineer the calcium-activated protease, which then affected the transcription factor, which then affected FLAIR, which is a single polypeptide chain that itself contains the transcription factor I was talking about, and this activates whatever your fluorescent protein is. So I know it sounds complicated. It's like a series of like cascades, and basically it's like a domino effect of like one thing activating another. And then both light and calcium have to arrive at the same time to enable the transcription factor to drive the expression of the fluorescence. And I just think it's really cool how it's really specific to this rise in calcium activity happening.
Yeah, that's amazing that you can have an internally generated fluorescent signal from a biological mechanism.
Yeah, and then this can be visualized using like confocal microscopes, you know? You don't even need to be super fancy.
Yeah, so to get more into how a fluorescent microscope works is that it has light that illuminates the sample, and then it has cameras that detect the emission. And this can be of various types. So the most basic type would be a wide field fluorescence microscope, which just emits a beam of light simultaneously to illuminate the whole specimen. And then a more commonly used type, which is of better resolution, is confocal microscopy, also known as one photon microscopy, which involves a laser that scans the sample one location at a time. And so it has a higher resolution. It's really cool how confocal microscopy works because it takes advantage of the laser, and this can be of 2 main different types. So there's laser scanning confocal microscopy and also spinning disk confocal microscopy. And this basically has to do with the movement of the laser, because as I mentioned, you're scanning the image essentially with a laser moving to different points on the sample, and that makes up the image. And so in laser scanning microscopy, which is more widely used, the specimen is scanned with an excitation laser that moves through a pinhole, and the laser and pinhole remain stationary, but the location that they are focused is moved optically across the specimen by a pair of oscillating mirrors. And the fluorescence intensity at each spatial point is then collected pixel by pixel to make up a final image. And you can increase or decrease the pinhole size to change the Z axis or the depth that you're imaging at. But with a spinning disc confocal microscope, this has a higher acquisition speed because by using a spinning disc, it takes advantage of multiple scanning points. So there's multiple pinholes and then the disc spins while each pinhole serves as a point source of light, and the return fluorescence has to also pass through that corresponding pinhole. Basically, the disc spins and the light moves through multiple pinholes, and then the emitted light moves back through the same corresponding pinhole, and that creates the image. So it's faster because it's more simultaneous than the laser scanning, which is literally like moving one at a time to each position. And I find it quite cool how like these simple technologies to do with the positioning of pinholes and mirrors can affect what image you get out, which is essentially like the history of microscopy. It was just an elaboration of different components to make up microscopes that can do different things, where the light, it's just directing light, really.
Yeah. It is interesting. I think you need a physics degree to also have a better understanding of...
Definitely.
I would never have come up with like the spinning disc thing. Like that sounds so crazy that it would even work in the first place.
Yeah. And then to enhance the ability to image at greater depths, we have two-photon microscopy, which is very similar to one-photon microscopy, but it involves using two photons of light that arrive simultaneously to illuminate a specific position of the sample. And this requires a relatively specialized high-powered pulsed laser, but then the sample only emits one photon, which can then be captured by the camera. So those are the three main types of fluorescence microscopy.
Yeah, and with all of these different microscopes, you get higher resolution and higher signal-to-noise ratio. And the cool thing about two-photon imaging is that it prevents photobleaching because of the far red and high specificity.
Yeah, like photobleaching is a really common problem where taking an image can lead to the fluorescent molecule losing fluorescence. So that's a real problem for microscopy, and especially in samples that are live imaging where you want to image over time, which is why two-photon microscopy is most useful in live imaging. And also, as I mentioned, the other big advantage is that you can image at greater depths. And so when people do imaging in animals like zebrafish or mice in vivo, two-photon microscopy is extremely useful because you wouldn't be able to reach as great a depth with one-photon microscopy.
Yeah.
So, for example, two-photon microscopy has been used a lot to study how neural activity relates to behavior in zebrafish, because zebrafish can be transparent and you can image a large area at one time, and you can do this while they are, you know, just swimming around, which is so cool.
Yeah.
And there was a paper by a group in the Max Planck Institute where they studied social behavior in zebrafish using two-photon calcium imaging. And so they were able to use two-photon imaging to find activity hotspots in the brain during specified social behaviors. And so they basically had fish in a tank while they presented visual stimuli. And the visual stimulus was a moving stimulus to mimic the movement of neighboring fish because they wanted to study social behavior. So they had one stimulus that was like a continuous movement of light, and that's supposedly repulsive. But then another one, which is bout-like, which means that it mimicked biological behavior of another fish, and that's attractive because zebrafish swim in shoals and they are very sociable and they don't like to be alone. So they are attracted to other fish. And basically, while imaging them during all these different types of stimuli, they were able to characterize areas that were specifically active for each stimulus. And they showed that there were multiple areas that were active distributed across the brain, and there was an area in the dorsal thalamus that was socially activated. And then they went on to use other methods to characterize the connectivity of that region and how it's specifically involved in the behavior. But I thought that this study was a really good example of how you can use two-photon microscopy to characterize brain regions that are involved in certain behaviors.
Yeah, I think it's awesome, and especially because you can use it in like freely moving animals, which is naturalistic and obviously very ethologically relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, zebrafish are an amazing model because they are transparent, and so it makes for some really cool imaging.
Yeah.
And there has also been three-photon microscopy, which you can go to even like deeper depths. But the problem with this one is then you lose a lot of the temporal resolution. So unless you're willing to compromise on that, I think the two-photon is probably like the Goldilocks one for like in vivo stuff, especially when like recording neuronal activity, which is like the temporal accuracy is extremely important.
Yeah. Which also just emphasizes that with all these tools, you can get as fancy as you want and as expensive as you want, but you need to think about what is the most appropriate for your research question, because like wide field fluorescence microscopy is still extremely useful, although it's the most simple. And its great advantage is that it's super quick because you're lighting up the whole sample at once. And so the image can be easily captured with very little time. But then the method is more suitable for very thin slices or samples, like single layers of cells, like in cell culture, because of this depth issue, like it doesn't have the same ability to go to a really great depth.
I just wanted to finish off just by saying that I think it's cool that imaging methods permit neuronal activity to be tracked through non-electric measures, and it translates neuronal activity into optical ones, and given the visual domain being the one that humans speak, I think it's nice that we've developed all of these techniques that we can, I guess, read the brain in a language that we can understand very intuitively.
Yeah, which is something I've also spoken about before, because we love to think visually, and I think a lot of people are much more attracted to microscopy than, for example, electrophysiological methods, which, you know, you're just essentially looking at lines of different shapes. But with microscopy, you have colors.
Yeah.
And you have shapes and colors, and it's just beautiful. I mean, like, I love doing imaging. It's just, like, so motivating and often relaxing when it works.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see individual cells and the things you've labeled and, like, the biochemistry that you've been playing around with, and you're not sure if it's going to work, and then you can just see it as a shape and a color.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it really is amazing that we have these tools for looking into the brain.
Yeah.
And on that note, we'll end today's episode here. We'd like to thank Scientifica again for collaborating with us to create this episode series. And Scientifica is one of the world's leading producers for imaging and electrophysiological equipment. And I would definitely check out their website for resources about a lot of these different techniques, as they have an excellent blog and plenty of resources on their website. And also check them out for any equipment that you may be looking for to carry out your research.
Yeah, and if you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to share it with your friends. We really appreciate the support.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at neuroverse_pod, and check out our website, neuroversepod.com, for more information.
Thanks for listening.